Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. And today you will know, if you were listening to Rachel there on the 1 o'clock news, or indeed the news all day, that the disappeared are back in the news. This is the group of 17 people who were abducted, murdered and secretly buried during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Heartbreaking news today that in one of those searches for one of the disappeared, Joe Linsky, there were human remains exhumed from a grave in County Monaghan 4 months ago. And today it was revealed that they were not the remains of Joe Linsky. You can imagine the heartbreak for Joe Linsky's family when they discovered that. And indeed, it turns out that they weren't the remains. The remains that were exhumed weren't connected to the family who had that grave, whose family grave that was either. So I suppose more questions there. But I want to bring in somebody now who will know very well how Joe Linsky's family will feel today. Dimpna Kerr, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Dimpna, you are, of course, Columba McVeigh's sister. And just, I suppose, to remind people, I'm sure a lot of people will know Columba's story at this stage, because there's been so many searches for him. He was disappeared, nearly 50 years ago now, the October 75.
Halloween night, 75, Columba went missing, yeah.
Yeah. He was only 19.
He was 19. And it's a long time, isn't it?
I cannot even begin to imagine the torture that has been for all of you. Tell me, when you heard that news today about Joe Linsky, what were you thinking?
Well, you just know how Maria and the family are going to be feeling. Their hearts are broken again. You wouldn't believe, you think your heart could only break once. But trust me, on something like this, it's a heartbreak every time that it's not a success story there. It's just heartbreak. That's the only way I can say it, heartbreaking.
And you know as well, because I know a lot of the families, and there's a small number of you left now, which is a terrible club to be in. There were 17 in all identified at the time of the Good Friday Agreement. How many families are still waiting?
There's four as part of that group, yeah.
Yeah.
There's four of us.
And in your case...
But having said that, all the other families, the ones who have found their loved ones, they're all in it with us. They still keep going with us, which is so brilliant.
Because really only ye know what that feels like. Only the families who have been put into this situation.
Exactly. It's only them that knows. And it's the ones who have found their loved ones. Their support keeps us going. Because they'll say, yes, we've been there. We've been, just keep going. Don't give up. Just keep going. They are so important to the families of the ones who are still missing.
And when you get word, I mean, in your case, it's just been so hard, because those searches have been started and stopped so often. Can you just remind us, Dimpna, what the story? Because it's a bog in County Monaghan that has been identified.
It's Bragan Bog.
Yeah.
And it's, well, I couldn't even tell you what size it is. I just know it's absolutely massive. And when you drive off the road and you go up that track, there's a certain point of it. And I know that when I get to that point, the hair stands on the back of my neck. And you go up there and you're looking out into this vast place, and you just, wow, there's a thousand things going through your mind. And you fight to keep your tears back, because there's you're going up there and the ones that are doing the searches and that, and they're speak to you, and you have to go up with a smile on your face and talk to them, and you know what I mean? The support we get of them is unbelievable as well.
Yeah.
And you look out there and I can feel myself screaming. It's like this voice is shouting, Columba, where are you? Columba. But it doesn't come out of my mouth. It's there. It's just, it's all, you understand what I'm saying.
I do. It's been, what, six or seven official searches?
I would say six.
Yeah.
It could have been seven. I'd say six, definitely. But who knows? It's gone on that long, you know what I mean? I'm just, it shouldn't have gone this long. There's somebody out there. There is somebody out there that knows exactly where to what to say. Mm-hmm. And for God knows what reason, I don't know why they're not saying it. Because they've nothing to lose.
Yeah, because it's important to say and remind people again that your family, and in fact none of the families of the disappeared, are looking for anybody to be prosecuted at this stage for this.
It's not about prosecutions. It's about finding the remains of my brother and taking him to the chapel in Donoughmore for a funeral mass, and then taking him across the road and putting his coffin in the grave beside our mum and dad. That's it. You know, and people say, oh, you just want closure. I don't like the word closure. And I've said that so many times. I don't like that word closure. Closure is something that's done with and then forgotten. I don't want to forget about Columba. I want Columba put in the grave in Donoughmore, that when I go over, I can go up there to that grave, I go up and see my mum and dad. That might sound stupid, but you go up to my mum and dad, and I can go up and see him as well. That's it. That doesn't seem a big ask, does it?
No, it doesn't. When you think about Columba, I mean, we've all seen that photograph. I think anybody who's at all has tuned into this story is a kind of a jaunty photograph of Columba with the hat.
That was from Donoughmore Youth Club. That's where that was taken from. That was from the Youth Club Donoughmore when we used to do talent contests for all the different youth clubs around about, and that's where that was taken from. It was the minstrel show.
When I think of
Columba, I now think like Columba was 2.5 years younger than me, right? I'll be 72 this year. When I look at myself in the mirror, I see a 70-odd-year-old woman looking back at me, right? Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine Columba any other way than the way he was when he was younger. He's never grown, you know what I mean? And that's the sad part. And I think in today as well, people have videos and all the rest. I can't tell you what Columba sounds like. All that's gone.
Yeah, even photos. We didn't have the cameras and all.
No, we don't have the photographs. We don't have it. Everybody's got a phone now and they take photographs whenever they want, and if they don't like it, they can delete it. We took them with a camera. You had to leave them into the chemist to get them developed. And just sometimes they come back and, well, they weren't worth keeping.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think for a year, I mean, I've thought about this so many times when you hear that another search is starting for Columba. And I think, what does that do to you and to Columba's family to, you know, get your hopes up every time? What does that feel like?
I know, and this is where the commission, and they do tell us, like, don't, you know what I mean? They try and keep you grounded on it, if that's the right way to say it. But I'm sorry, I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I'm like that. you know, I know Maria Linsky will have had funeral arrangements and everything in place for Joe. And the reason I know that is because it's just part of the what you do when there's a search starting. Any search had ever started for Columba. Since my mum died, not before, but when my mum was alive, I didn't do it. But since my mum died and that, I sit there at my table and I have my pen and my piece of paper and I'm going through and I think, right, I like that hymn and I like that hymn and I like this one and I like this reading and I like... And you're doing all this. Now, I have no doubt my brothers are probably doing the same. Maybe they're not. But I think if you asked them, they would say, oh, yeah, they have an idea of what they're doing. And then when that search finishes, I rip that page up and I throw that away with tears in my eyes as I'm throwing it away. And then when another search starts, I sit and do the same thing again. I said to whoever I spoke to this morning earlier on, every time a new search starts for Columba, this sounds silly, I go and buy myself a new pair of black shoes and you start putting stuff in for the funeral. You start making plans for the funeral.
Yeah.
It's just human nature, really, isn't it? And yeah.
And your mom, of course, obviously went to her grave not knowing what happened to Columba. And he actually didn't even know, he wasn't even identified as one of the disappeared for many years after he did go missing.
No, Mummy knew exactly what happened to Columba. Mummy was still alive when the Good Friday Agreement come out, and that's when we were told officially what happened to Columba. Mm-hmm. So she did know what happened to him.
But as in, she didn't know obviously where he ended up.
Yeah. Oh, she was up. There was a couple of searches in her lifetime, and she was up at that bog when she went up to them, because she brought them up all kinds of stuff, like for the ones who were searching. She used to always say, "No, you need to look after them." And to be truthful, I think I'm the one that's carried that on from my mum, because Sandra from Wave, she takes me up when I go over when there's a search on, and she knows, because we stop and I buy all kinds and bring them up to them. But me mum done that, so I feel it's my job to continue that.
So you bring up stuff to keep them going, basically?
To keep them going, yeah.
And just to show you how much you appreciate it, yeah.
Tea, coffee, cup of soups, sweets, biscuits. I've even stopped and got them breakfast, you know what I mean, and done that. Depends on what time of day I go, but it's just to keep them going. Yeah, it's to keep them going.
And I'm sure...
My son now knows that when a search starts, he orders me disposable cups off Amazon so that I can bring a ream of them over with me each time I go over to the search, so that they'll have a clean cup. It's important to look after the ones that are up there doing that work.
I'm sure that they are all very invested in this as well, Demna.
Yeah, and on Palm Sunday when we go to the Mass, a lot of that search team will be at the Mass on Palm Sunday with us all. They are invested. And at the end of these searches, when they're not successful, they're as disappointed as anybody else. You know, that's how invested they are. They really are. They're a fabulous team.
It's just such a terrible, terrible situation you've all been.
It's a club. A club nobody wants to join.
Will you stay with us for a moment, Demna? Because there's somebody else who will know exactly how you feel, but has come out the other side of that, and that is a Seamus Ruddy's sister, Anne. Anne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Again, I was just what I asked Demna there. What your thoughts were when you heard that news today? about Joe Linsky's remains?
Well, I've been there a few times when I got that news, and all I can say is the hope that you that would have sustained you for that time when they are searching just leaves you, and you feel yourself that you're very bereft, and you really don't know where to turn to or who to turn to, and you just feel, I think, very, very alone. Because you're now dealing with a situation where, you know, he's not where they said he was. The team are bereft because they haven't found him. And you really feel that you are on a lonely, lonely path.
Yeah. There were three searches for Seamus before he was finally found, wasn't there?
That's right. We were lucky enough to get three searches for him. Seamus was disappeared in France. So we had a more difficult situation than the other families in one respect. And whenever a search was taking place in France, we would have been there with the team. And it was just marvellous having that team from the ICLVR to have them working with us, and it was like them, you know, holding our hand all the way through this. I just call it, it's like a nightmare having to live through, you know, the search every single day, and hoping beyond hope that, you know, he will be found and you will give him a decent burial, a Christian burial. And that is the problem that we have now, you know, with looking after Joe Linsky's family. We've got that, you know, we now have to try and lift them up and give them the hope, you know, that maybe another search will take place at some stage and that they will find them. The team are so experienced in finding them. You know, it's been such a success story over this past 20 years that we have great faith in the team that looks after the actual recovery of the remains.
That's important to say, that they have done such incredible work, and they have, against the odds, recovered so many remains and brought them back to their families. And just like you did finally, as you say, get to lay Seamus to rest with your parents. What was that like?
Well, you know, I would describe it as a bittersweet moment. And I now know what that actually means. You know, you hear that term and you just wonder, what does that really mean? But now I know what that means. And it was a time of joy, firstly, and then sadness. And I think that is the thing that we live with as members of the families that disappeared. We live with this deep-rooted sadness where we can't fix it. And then when we do get them home and we're able to give them a burial in a place where we choose, not where the persons who murdered them, not that place, in the place that we want to put them into, that we give them that peace. And then once we've got, you know, we bury them, you then get an inner peace again to know that, you know, it's sorted.
And I know your mother passed away before you did find out where Seamus's remains had been buried.
That's right.
And she was obviously, from the moment he went missing, searching, hoping that she would see him again.
Absolutely, yes. But it was my mother, and just before she died, 6 months before she died, and it was 10 years after he had disappeared in 1995, my mother put his name on the headstone in, you know, on my father's grave. And she said, it's written in marble.
Yeah.
We will all remember him. And I think a few other mothers also did this. And because I think it's very, very important that they're not forgotten. That's very, very important.
I just, Debna, you've been listening to Anne there, and I know you know each other.
Oh, great friends. Yeah, great friends. Yeah.
What do you talk about when you do meet Debna?
What do we talk about? Everything. We laugh, we cry. We do it. We talk about everything. Just, I couldn't pick one thing out in particular, but we talk about everything. But it's lovely when we're together and when you're with families who have found their loved ones and they're there to console you and to tell you to keep going, don't lose hope. Hope's the last thing any of us want to lose. But sometimes you do struggle with it as well. But they got, you know, they know to keep going and they keep us strong, which is great, really.
And do you feel that, or I wonder, is there kind of in other circumstances we call about survivor guilt, but do you feel a bit of guilt almost that you have got your completeness, as Jimna would call it, and others haven't?
In one respect, you do feel a bit of that, and you don't really want to harp on about I've got him, you know. That's not the way of it. That isn't the way of it. Because I think because we've experienced, you know, in Dipna's case, you know, like 50 years of this. In our case, it was over 30 years of this real sadness. That now we don't proclaim it from the rooftops or anything. We're just, you know, quietly comforting Dempna and her family and Joe Linsky's family. And I think that, you know, we need to give them this support, because it's a very lonely place when you are still searching.
Dempna, I leave you with a last word for the Linsky family and Maria.
My heart goes out to Maria. My heart goes out to Maria at the minute. I know exactly how she's feeling. And she will have my support all the way through. She can phone me any time of day or night to talk to me, and I will always be available to speak to her.
Dempna, thank you so much. And Anne, thank you so much. And Dempna, I really, really, really hope that you get the news you want. And I'm going to put that number out there, because as you say, if there's anybody who has any information, the Independent Commission is there.
Yeah.
It's a Dublin number, 602-8655, 602-8655, and that's the number for the confidential phone number for the Independent Commission for the location
number.
Of.
Yes.
Yeah, that's important to say. It's confidential.
Yes.
There'll
it's
be
confidential.
No prosecutions. There is no downside to coming forward with information at this stage, and only an upside for all the families.
No, that's fine.
Dempna, thank you. And Anne, thank you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're going to leave that there. And obviously, we wish our very best to all the families who are still waiting. That very, very sad story. I want to move on, though, because tomorrow the Dáil returns after the St. Patrick's week's break. And it's back at 2 o'clock tomorrow. And they still have not sorted out the row over speaking time. Astonishingly. Brian, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are we?
I'm good. I wonder how the TDs are feeling now, heading into this again tomorrow. What's your take on it? Because we've got people saying the opposition are absolutely right to hold the line on this. That you know, if you're either in opposition or you're in government, you can't be half pregnant, as they say. You can't be half opposition or half government. What do you think?
Well, you see, each TD in the Dáil is elected by his constituency to represent his constituency. And he should be allowed to talk. It doesn't matter whether he's a member of any political party or none. He's there to represent his constituency and he should be allowed to talk. This thing like that, only the heads of the political parties are allowed to talk and the backbenchers sit on their hands and every now and then they take the hands off the bum and they stick them up in the air and say, we agree with this. And then they put them back underneath their backside. That's ridiculous. Each TD, we should know whether he's for the legislation or against the legislation or whether he has reservations about the legislation. And that has nothing got to do whether he's a member of a party that's in government or a member of a party that's in opposition. He's there by the people to legislate on behalf of the people, not on behalf of a political group or a group of independents. He's there to represent his constituency. Nobody else. He's not there to represent Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, Labour, anybody. He's not. He's there to represent his constituency and he should represent them by being able to speak in the Dáil on any particular matter that comes before the Dáil and that the Dáil has to deal with. He's there as a legislator and that's it.
Okay. How do they manage the Dáil time, though? Because obviously there has to be some system in place where certain amounts of time are set aside to discuss various legislation or whatever happens to be coming up on the order of business. So surely to God, there has to be some system of deciding who, it can't be a free-for-all or they'd never get through a day's work.
Well, first of all, they should be spending more time in the Dáil. And as regards to what you're saying, like any political meeting that you go to or public meeting you go to, the chairman would, you put up your hand and the chairman would say, you can speak. And everybody else stays quiet when you're speaking. Then when you're finished your speech, she picks somebody else up, well, it is a she at the moment, but the chairman or the chairwoman can pick somebody else to speak. And that would be there. I mean, it's not rocket science to be able to devise a system where politicians, not the parties, the politicians can speak. I mean,
but are you saying
they don't speak? They don't spend enough time in the Dáil for the politicians to get to speak. Sorry,
Brian. I was going to say, are you? Do you have an issue with the whip system? Then is that what you're saying, that you don't think that politicians should be, you know, have to vote along party lines?
I don't. I believe that the whip system is used by political parties, all political parties, to keep their members in check. And if the members in check, they say, right, you're out the door and we won't support you in the next election under our flag. The people are elected by the people, not by parties. But they should represent the people. And the party whips, that's a form of censorship because the party whip decides who can and who can speak. It's censorship.
But Brian, I'm just struggling to see how you could get business done if you can't guarantee a certain amount of votes for government. Like if cabinet agrees something.
That's a different issue, no, Katie.
Well, isn't that what we're talking about? How do you get
speaking rights?
Yeah.
I mean, the government is formed generally by the biggest political party. In this case, it took 2¾ parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Independents. Mm-hmm. That has nothing got to do with speaking rights. TDs can vote if they wish to go into a pact with any particular group. They're tied into it, but that shouldn't stop them from speaking. Voting rights and speaking are two different things whatsoever.
Now, I've no beef with any side on this, but I'm saying they would say that there's no suggestion of stopping people from speaking. The point was that the opposition deputies felt we had to be very clear about who is an opposition deputy and who is a government-supporting deputy, and there should be no dilution of that dividing line. And they were saying that the difficulty here was that this third kind of hybrid TD that was being introduced, this idea that you were neither government nor opposition, or they were calling them an other, that this was diluting the notion of a government being held to account by an opposition in the Dáil.
But you see, there again is the people who would call themselves in the opposition would be the whip of that party or the head of that party would decide who would speak on their behalf on a particular matter and would give the party line. The individuals who are sitting at the back of the room don't have any say. So the constituents don't know whether they're for, against, or anything about it, because they'll go back to their constituents and say, the party is for this or the party is against that. That's ridiculous. We should know from the TD himself how he wishes to address the legislation, whether he's for it, whether he's against it. And
but
that
but
all
Brian,
TDs.
Yeah, but Brian, if you're the TD you backed because he was a Fine Gael TD, say, or a Fianna Fáil TD, and you backed him because you agree with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil policies in the run-up to an election, and that's one of the reasons you supported them, and then they go into the Dáil and they don't support the government legislation. Don't people need to know where TDs stand in the run-up to when you're electing them and what they're likely to do after the election?
You might have remembered there was a fellow called Pat Rabbit. He was a member of the Labour Party, a leader of the Labour Party. And he said in an interview afterwards, he says, isn't that what you say before an election? He had promised something and then he wouldn't do it after he getting into government.
Well, now let me just say, Brian, because I know we'll get a call about it. He said that in an interview or in a panel show with Sean O'Rourke, and Sean O'Rourke has corrected us a couple of times on that and said that that's actually the context of that isn't entirely fair the way that has been put forward. I'll just throw that in there before somebody else comes out and says it to us. Brian, will you hang on? Because I've got Declan on the other line. Declan, how are you?
How are you? I've a little bit of a head cold now, so forgive me if I sound a little hoarse. That's okay. How are you, Katie?
You sound lovely, Declan.
All right, okay, sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Where do you stand on this?
No, I think you're right. You're either in or out. You can't have this Lanigan's ball. And as it would be the very same as if a hurling team and the referee blows the whistle and he says to your man, no, I want to put on the other jersey for 10 minutes on the other team and I want to poke the ball down the other end of the field. So you're either on one side or you're on the other side. Simple as that. I mean, these people are trying to have it both ways. So how could you have Danny Healy-Ray berating his brother as a junior minister? He should be actually sitting behind his brother on the government benches.
And when the government
these non-aligned deputies or whatever that are supporting the government, they will actually be using up opposition time if they're allowed to speak as opposition deputies.
Now,
but yet they're supporting the government. That would have been the very same as the last government, the Green Party, deciding, well, we have three or four TDs, we let them speak from the opposition side on this, you know, so. You're with the government or you're not. They're just trying to have it both ways. And as I said, it'd be the very same as the fella on the hurling field and he says to the ref, no, listen, I want to play 10 minutes with the other team. I need time to put on a different jersey. And then the ref blows the whistle and says, yeah, okay, now you're back with the other side.
I'll just say what Helen McEntee was on today and she was explaining that after all the months now that have passed, I mean, in fairness, it's been 3 months, which is actually kind of mind-boggling. What they have come up with is that they've rejigged the speaking time and that actually the time that those non-aligned or Lowry-aligned deputies, we call them, are taking is not actually eating into what had been opposition time up to now. So that they're saying that it's not actually eating into the opposition time. So what's their problem?
Right, well, let's wait and see. No. You're either signed into government or you're not signed into government. I mean, sure, Michael Lowry and his people probably negotiated more about this government than people in Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael did with one another. you know, I mean, they're, that's you know, they'll be the ones that will be parading around the constituency making an announcement about something, and yet they'll be able to go and speak from the opposition about something that they're not happy with either. No, you're either you're in government or you're not. It's like, as I said, you're either on a hurling team or you're not on the. You can't be on two hurling teams at the same on the same day out on the pitch.
Do you think they're going to come under pressure though? Because I mean, we're hearing now there might be a walkout tomorrow. Given
well, let them use whatever tactics they want to use. Let them use whatever parliamentary tactics they want to use. That's fine. That's their prerogative. That's what people elect them to do.
But do you think people will keep supporting the line because there's big issues coming up down the tracks for us?
Yeah, I accept that. Yeah, but that's the responsibility of the Taoiseach and Tánaiste and the government to deal with that.
Okay, stay there, Declan. No, stay there, Declan, with your hurley there. You're playing senior hurling there, Declan. David, good afternoon.
I tell you, I've been royally entertained now. That gentleman is actually very right when he says that you're either on the hurling team or you're not on that hurling team. But like when you consider it's taken so many months to get a doll, to get a, what do you call it, the mandate for what they want to do. And they're now wasting more and more time. And I believe there's only three pieces of legislation put through. One is to have more ministers, the other is to have more junior ministers, and the other is to have a pay rise. And here they are now fighting more about time, speaking time and not speaking time. You know, what are we paying? Like, there's no business in this country would put up with this shenanigans that they're carrying on with. You know, they haven't done a day's proper work for this country. They've fluted off to America. They've been all over the world for Paddy's Day. And three pieces of legislation and all it is about themselves. And people are just fed up with this. Like we have an oil, the price of heat and oil is going up. Electricity is going up. Your day-to-day expenses are going up. And they don't give a shenanigans about anybody in this country. And I think they're just dragging out, oh, what do we talk about? What do we do now? Oh, we'll have another fight over the next 6 weeks about these dual speaking rights. You know, the rules are there. Play by the rules or resign tomorrow.
So are you blaming the government for this, not the opposition who are kicking up about it?
The whole lot of them. Like, this should have been sorted out. This could be sorted out. Put them in a room and bang their heads together, as one that other man sort of said. You know, let them get it sorted. It's partly the government as well, because they've basically said to these people, right, you support us and we'll give you this extra speaking time or we'll do this for you and we'll do that for you. As that gentleman said, those independents know exactly what's coming down the road. They'll be standing in constituencies announcing that this is going to happen, and then the government member will come out and say, oh yeah, we're going to give extra amount of money for such and such in roads in North Tipperary or whatever it is, you know. But as the man says, Michael Lowry, who's technically an opposition man supporting the government, would have known 3 days beforehand. So I think the government need to sort themselves out first and say, you know, draw the lines and say this is the way it should be and get it sorted, you know.
Can you figure out why, David? Can you get a handle on why they are so committed to sorting out the regional independence with this? Like,
there's somebody has promised something to somebody behind the scenes that you and I don't know about, and maybe you're in a better position to find out. But there's some shenanigans, underhand shenanigans, going on, and therefore they don't want it to come out, you know, what exactly is being given.
Okay, well, we better not say underhand shenanigans, David, because we don't know what we're talking about, really. But it is a bit of a mystery why there is such, you know, so much political capital as being committed to this one issue when there's so many important issues that need to be dealt with. Will you, David, will you hang on, because I've got Kieran. Kieran, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you? Yeah, listening to everything there. First of all, I have no party, nor do I have any political leaning whatsoever. I think it's all down to basic democracy. You see, if everybody has a democratic right to talk, then everybody has a chance. But if your lust for power is such that you must have a party, and you must lead it, well, then you can't have even your own backbenchers speaking. Now, they can say whatever they want with this few extra minutes, but there is always the party whip. And if they disagree with the party whip, well, then they leave the party. But I'm fed up with people coming around here to me and promising me the sun, moon and stars, wanting to represent me in the Dáil, when all they want to do is represent their party with me. But, you know, do you understand what I mean?
I understand what you mean, but then, sure, if you don't like the party TDs, would you be tempted to vote for the independent TDs? And maybe that's why independents have done so well for the last one.
If I vote for an independent TD, right, and he isn't elected, the party TD cannot speak on my behalf simply because he doesn't get a chance. He may be able to send a letter to his minister or whatever, but that does not raise my problem.
But some would say, Kieran, that he's a lot more useful to you because he's got more access to power than the opposition backbencher.
He may have access to power, but he hasn't access to cause. A discussion on a situation. Whereas if somebody can speak in the Dáil, regardless of party, and this is not eating into opposition time as I read it, it's going to be extra time. So you're going for actual democracy rather than party democracy.
Okay. Now I'm wondering where all this... I'm just wondering where this new clock is that we're finding all this extra time that we didn't have before.
It's down to actual democracy, and let them work. Let them come in Monday afternoon and Friday morning. You know, or as we used to have to do, we had to go to school on Saturday morning. You know, these guys are, you know, they're going home, getting expenses and everything else, and they're not doing the work for it.
Yeah, no.
Get the backbenchers, say their part, and do the work.
Yeah, well, again, they'd say that the least of their work is what happens in the Dáil, but...
I know, I let them do that. I know every parish pump is political. Is a political...
Okay.
What do you call them? Soapbox.
I have to take a break. Kieran, thanks for that. We'll take that break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I want to move on now because there is a new campaign, a nationwide campaign today. You might have heard the ads already telling people that they need to control their dogs, that it's not your dog's fault, it's yours. Desi, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie.
Yeah, Desi, you're a sheep farmer?
I am, yes. I'm chairman at ICSA down here in Wexford, and I welcome the initiative there by both ministers on the responsibility of dog ownership.
You think there's too many dogs around now, do you?
There's a lot of dogs around. Since the pandemic, a lot of people got dogs just because they're home in the houses and that way. And, you know, when children wanted a dog, and I don't say anything wrong with that, they're entitled to do that. But there are an awful lot of dogs around. And it's down to the most of them are very responsible dog owners. Like, it's just that there are the few people that don't, are not responsible enough and they think the dog don't do any harm. But I know through experience, it's the pit. It's not this big, you know, Rottweiler type dog that's doing the damage. It's the pit dog that does the damage, believe it or not. They get home back in the morning. The people never even know they have the sheep, and here they're back there again. You know, for breakfast, as we say. But and it's not the hungry dog that chases sheep. It's just the chase. The dogs. That's the dogs are bred. They're a hunting dog, and you know they love the chase, and that's what they'll do. You know.
And you say, like, I suppose again, if you're talking about people who maybe only got a dog in the last few years, you know, with the pandemic and all that. It might be inexperienced dog owners that might not actually appreciate what their dog could get up to at night time.
I think you're right. Because dogs that way, you know, they tend to travel at night. They will travel in packs. And it's just the ordinary terrier type, you know, that will go. And, you know, so no, what you're saying is right.
It's down to ownership. It's down to responsibility, and microchipping is very important. Like all pups, like before they ever leave a person's farm or a yard or wherever the puppies are born, they should be microchipped, and not just that, but the ownership then they should put into the ownership of the new owner that's buying the pup. And once that's in new ownership, straight away if that dog then is caught, then it's only a little microchip thing in your hand. They run on the dog's neck, and you're able to get the number up straight away. It's a very simple little device, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, so that will work. But that should be mandatory, you know. Every pup should be microchipped, and no pup should leave a place without being microchipped, you know.
And you, I know you had a bad experience last year, Desi.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
Yes. Then you got to say, and not just, I don't want to be on the way talking about myself, I tell you, it's just that a neighbour of myself and myself here got caught with dogs. And the strange thing about it, it's not what sheep they killed. It's the running of the sheep into gripes, into rivers, and it's not what sheep dies on the day. They die afterwards. That's the sad part about it. And it's down, you know, and it's the whole emotion of it all. And, okay, yes, there's no question about it, there's a financial loss, but the emotion loss is even worse because it's terrible to see sheep, down and they can't get up and just die overnight, like, just die in a couple of days, the word, you know.
Just talk us through very quickly, what actually happened on your farm last year, wasn't it?
Yes, well, around this time last year, dogs come and they killed that. You know, there was a number of sheep here that was down. I think there was only a couple, one or two dead at the time, but the rest of them were down, and we got them in dikes, you know, in gripe ways and that type of thing. And another one had drowned herself in a river. And then the neighbour then, they had a lot more sheep. And, you know, the way it happened, it was beside a garage, and there was a camera on the garage, and the sheep go up by the garage, by the gateway, and that's how we caught the dogs. That's what happened. We were three of the dogs on camera, and that's how we got it, you know. But there was no problem with the people that owned the dogs. Those dogs were well-minded. There was no problem that way, and they paid up actually everything that was, you know, there was no problem whatsoever with those people. But it's just that, you know.
And were they shocked? And we're not going to say who we're talking about now. But were they shocked at what their dogs had been up to?
They were shocked. They come here. They come down to our house here, and they couldn't believe it happened because the dogs were at home in their own yard in the morning, lying in the garden, and as if they never started all night. You know, so that's the way dogs are. The dogs would come back overnight, clean themselves up, and they'd be lying out there in the morning as if that never happened. So that is the problem. And these were very ordinary little dogs. No, they weren't big, rough dogs of any kind. Ordinary pets. And, you know, so that's right, you're up again. So it's really down to, responsibility of ownership as such, you know. And I just see here on the statement that the minister's made, they're going to bring in 40 additional wardens. That's very welcome. But the only way that's going to work is, like, we go on a walk on a Sunday down to, I'm going to say Kilmore there, and down to South Mill, some lovely places down here in Wexford. That's a plug now for Wexford, that is. And there's people with dogs there along there, going walking along. Now, if a warden was on duty and he walked over to that person and he said to him, could I check your dog for a microchip? And that is how you're going to enforce that rule. There's no other way of doing it. And then straight away, you know then if that dog has belonged to that person or what the dog registered to that person. And then straight away, if it's not, then now you have a case straight away. And that's where the fines will come in, you know. But that's up to the wardens to sort that one out.
And do the wardens have that power, I wonder? Are they
I don't.
Allowed?
Then they should be. I mean, what good is a warden if they don't have some type of power to should have some type of, you know, power in place that they can do something like that, you know. So it's down to rules and regulations must be implemented. So they do have to have
implement those rules that are going to have those people out there on the street, you know.
Okay, Desi, will you hang on with me? I want to come back to this, but I do need to get another break in.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're talking about dog owners needing to be responsible for their dogs and attacks on sheep. I want to bring in Seamus now. Seamus, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very good, Seamus. You are farming sheep there in Glendalough, near Glendalough.
That's right, that's right.
Lovely part of the country.
It is beautiful.
This time of year, though, this is when you really worry about the dogs, don't you?
We do, really, because people come out on the weekends with their dogs and they don't mean to be doing anything wrong. And they go for walks up the hills and they leave their dog loose. The dog gets away. They follow a deer maybe first. And then the people go home without the dogs and then they're left there and then they start that sheep, you know, that way. So it's a bad thing like to happen.
And do people go home?
Be responsible.
Yeah, but do people go home without their dogs?
People will go home without their dog. They can't find them. Yes, has happened several times.
Okay. And have you had any losses?
Not this year, but a cousin of mine had a couple of sheep killed and next door neighbour had a few sheep killed locally. Yes, that's right, yeah.
And like Desi said, there is not just the actual sheep that might be attacked in person or in sheep's and it's actually the damage done, you know, that sheep who running and getting themselves into bad situations and maybe, you know, might die days later.
Sheep worries when they get a strange dog in the place, when they frighten them and they never get out of that stress after. It takes months. Some die that they won't eat or do nothing when the dog happens that way, you know.
And this is lambing season, of course, because you could be talking about pregnant sheep being ewes being worried.
That's right, and like to throw dead lambs then and all when that happens. Yeah, so it's a bad job to happen at any time of the year, but especially in the springtime on farmers.
And I know we talk about this comes up year after year after year. Like, have we ever really gotten a handle on it in terms of dog wardens are, you know, obviously there's this awareness campaign being run now. Has there ever been a time where, well, actually it was good when we did, you know, was there anything that actually managed it better?
Well, there's not really, but the only thing is, the likes of you now putting all this stuff up on television or radio and all, which is highlighting it, is a very good thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get highlighted and keep it highlighted more. And mostly, if sheep gets killed, they should be showed on television and all that as well. It's the scenes, when you go to a field and you see sheep killed, you don't forget it. Like, it's a worrying time for farmer as well as sheep and everyone else, you know that way.
Have you noticed, like Desi was telling us there, that there is a lot more dogs around, just more families have more dogs now?
Well, I live in Glendalough and the amount of dogs there in the weekends, and most days, but weekends especially, with people coming from Dublin and everywhere, like not just alone Dublin, everywhere, and they think they can, that the dog's under control. It's not on a lead. And they should be made to keep the dogs on leads and make sure they're bringing them home when they're going home, you know? So there's more dogs, of course.
Yeah, I suppose people think, you know, it's their chance when they get outside Dublin to let the dog off the lead. That's a nightmare from your situation.
A nightmare because, as I said here last year, several days on we graze on Brocken Mountain, which is right beside Glendalough, and the amount of dogs that's left overnight on the hill is unbelievable. And they don't say nothing about the dogs being on the hill. The next thing they'd start at sheep, you know. Every hill placed by the same Lemalure, everywhere you go, like, people has no respect when they go to the hill with the dogs. They let them loose and they think they can do what they like.
Seamus, hang on a second. Michael, are you there, Michael?
Hello.
Michael, you're also a sheep farmer.
Yes, yes, I keep sheep, yes.
And you, like Desi was saying, it's the small dogs he worries about. But you're saying...
No. The small dog will hunt with a big dog. It's the big dogs do more damage. The Rottweilers and the Labradors and dogs of that size, and they'll do the more damage. They catch the sheep by the throat, and the small dog will come in behind them. The small dog, it's the big dog does the most damage.
And
all dogs, even a poodle or a small dog will hunt sheep. It's a chase. It's in their nature to chase.
And Michael, have you lost sheep to dogs?
Oh, yes, we've lost sheep over the years, back since the 70s.
And is it getting any better?
Well, it is getting better now since the dog warden when the dog wardens come in. But it's people when guard dogs and people at the foothills, when their dog gets out, they go and kill because they're not under control. And national parks and all that, there's nobody looking after. The dogs are the health and they can go where they like. It's not every dog will obey.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Our dogs are not trained. They're not trained to come back and stay. They're just left roam.
They're
all right when they're in the garden or when they're in the house, but they're not used to being out in an open space, out in the hills and that.
Yeah.
And it's like that previous man said there, all the hills where the people are walking and forestries and that, they think when they're on a track in the forest, the middle of a forest, that there's nothing around them. A rabbit or a deer will get up and run and then the dogs will take off. And so the dog doesn't know where to go back to because he was never there before, maybe, you know. And then he'll get into a field and he'll kill and maybe he won't go home for a few days or maybe a week before the people will go look for him again.
Yeah, you can see it happening right enough. Before we go to the break, Desi.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying it was the small dogs you worry about, but...
Yeah, they're not really. See, I say small dog because, as that man said there, even down to the poodle, they will chase. And that's why when I say small dogs, you don't necessarily have to have this big dog that will chase sheep. A couple of handy-sized dogs will still chase them. They might not be able to catch them and kill them, but they will run them into gripes and into water and into places that they can't get out of, and they'll smother themselves. And the fright alone, especially yours, heavy and lamb, they're in trouble straight away with a big chase like that. They will like just go down and they won't get up again. That's the truth now with a chase like that. You know, so you know all dogs will do it, but that's why I said a small dog. People think when they have a little pet of a dog that he'll do no harm, but that little dog will still chase sheep the same as the big dog, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's the way I put it, you know?
Yeah, Desi, okay. So what you're saying basically is don't be complacent. Don't think your little pooch wouldn't be a danger to sheep. It can do massive harm anyway. Listen, Desi, I have to take a break, but thank you for that and a very important message to put out there today.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And before we go today, I want to go back to the story of the handy women that we were talking about. We had a lovely programme on, a lovely show on Friday, where we were hearing about these handy women who were the midwives who brought generations of Irish people into the world. They were midwives working out in the community who would travel around on their bikes mostly with the black bags on the carriers. Marion, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Great, Marion. You have a story about, is it your grandmother's aunt? Have I got that right?
That's right, Katie. But sorry, Katie, just during, I have to take the opportunity about the dogs because I'm IFA Carlow sheep chair and I was listening about the dogs, a very good highlight and it's on your programme. But we have the same problem on the Black Stairs on Mount Leinster. So just, you know, people keep dogs under control. very important.
Yeah,
sorry, Katie,
and a lot of, you'd have a lot of walkers down your way as well, Marion.
Yes,
so that's a,
yes,
a big important message to get out there. I hope we have made that message clear today.
Yes.
And quick, because I'm looking at the clock, Marion, tell me about your grandmother's aunt.
My grandmother's aunt, yes, she was a midwife. I think she lived in England, Katie, and she worked for many years on her bicycle, just like the people were spoken of, lovely stories on Friday. Uh-huh. And one story she told was one winter's night, a knock came to her door around 11 o'clock, and she had to leave with a young man to go to a carriage in the woods. And she delivered a baby. And he said to her, don't ever tell anybody you saw me. So some years after, she was working, I think it was in the comb, Katie. Mm-hmm. And she met this young woman again, but she said nothing was said.
So neither of them let on that they had been
neither
through this other...
Neither of them let on. No, that was one of the stories I remember my grandmother relating. I was also listening to Michael Dawson, Katie, and Michael and myself would come from the same neck of the woods. So I knew his grandmother, a great lady, Nurse Dawson, we always called her as children, and she was a great lady, highly respected indeed.
And that was the thing, that a lot of these women didn't just deliver babies, they were like the community nurse as well. They were the person that was turned to if there was any medical issues at all, or indeed any emotional issues even in some cases.
Yes, indeed, they were. They were pillars of community, Katie, and they were very knowledgeable. And that time, you know, there was no running water in houses, there was no electricity, there was no cars. Like, young women of today, or even of my generation, would hardly believe this to be possible, you know, but don't women travel through the night on their bicycles and in all kinds of weather? And I know Michael spoke about his mother and the Part 7 snow, Katie. And like, I came from Michael, at the foothills of Michael in the snow, you were really snowed in. And those women, they got there, they delivered babies, and they did everything. Like, they looked after the other children, and they put on meals, and they were extraordinary women their time.
They were extraordinary women, and I was saying I'd love to know more and do more about it. And indeed, we were saying on Friday, we need to do a full programme on that 1947 big snow and what was and wasn't done during it, because it was the most extraordinary time, and clearly from our callers, great stories passed down through families of what happened on the night of the big snow, or indeed on the months of the big snow, because that would obviously have went
right,
on for literally for months. Marion, hang on, I've got Eileen, if I can get, yes, I do have time. Eileen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie, how are you?
Great, Eileen. Now, who do we want to remember from your family?
Yeah, well, my mother was the midwife in the Whitechurch area in County Waterford. She was the midwife there from, I think it was approximately the late 1930s, until I did duty for her in before she retired in, I think it was 1973. She was very well known in the area, and there was a great camaraderie about the other midwives that she knew there. She knew a Nurse Lavin in Clashmore, a Nurse Troy in Clashmore, Nurse Power in Dungarvan, a Nurse Foley in Capquin, and her boss was a Nurse Sally Foley from Lismore. And then there was a Nurse O'Donnell in the Nair who she replaced at some times. And they all worked very well together. And I remember it very well. But I do remember my mother tackling a pony and trap. She's a beautiful trap, a brown trap with leather upholstery. And she used to tackle the trap and head off, as she said, to the Black Hill, which is in near Dungarvan in County Waterford. So she spent years at that, and she loved her job, but never, ever spoke about all she would say when she came home was, "Mother and baby are well." And I do remember the bag. She had this special bag. But her bag had to be returned to the health board, the health authority at that time. But I always remember her coming along with the rolls of cotton wool. And the rolls of cotton wool, they wrap the babies in cotton wool. So I think that's where the saying came from.
Is that actually where we got that
was
from?
Wrapped in cotton.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Is that where we got that phrase from?
I think so. If there was a premature baby, they would wrap the baby in cotton wool. And my mother would return for 10 days to the mother and baby. Because at that time, there were no cord clips. So, in other words, the umbilical cord was tied with a sterile string, really. And she would go back for 10 days to dress the umbilical cord and look at, and take care of the mother.
And did you have a sense of your mother being missing for big chunks of time when you were a child?
I did. She would go missing. She would go missing for 3 days or more, and she'd say, "I'm going. I won't be long, and I'll be back." But for her, not long was 3 or 4 days.
Right. Because they did all sorts for the families while they were there, because there was children to be looked after. And
no, I don't think my mother did anything like that now.
No?
I just think she stayed. No, I don't think she did. I think in her, she trained in, she was a proud Donegal woman. She trained in the Coombe in Dublin. She was appointed to the Waterford district. That was the Whitechurch district, which her whole district ranged between the Master McGrath Monument in Dungarvan back to Clashmore. Mm-hmm. No, that was a big district. But I don't think she did anything unless something was really necessary for the family. But she was a fully qualified nurse and was very proud of it. Yeah. But she never, ever, even when I was qualified, no, I didn't do any length of time doing it for her, only just in her last month. And I prayed to God I wouldn't get called out. But she was very, very proud of her job and I think was very well liked in the area.
Eileen, I'm going to have to go. I'm actually over time. But a lovely, lovely story again. And we've had so many lovely stories and we will come back to those. Today we had Niall McGonigan on sound. Our broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. Today's programme was produced by Annette Egan. And you can stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.